This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Buka Sekolah Kami is a coalition of teachers, parents, educational institutions, medical professionals and grassroots organizations who believe that the cost of school closures greatly outweigh the benefits. So they are advocating for policymakers to prioritize the reopening of schools on a national level and the need for a decentralized solution and an end to blanket policies. So in this, which is our second episode of our series of six on the issue, I'm going to be speaking to consultant child psychologist Katiana Azman about how school closures impact our children in terms of their mental and physical health, and also in terms of the development of their socio-emotional and critical thinking skills. I mean, ultimately, what we want to ask is, why is face-to-face learning and interaction so important for the kids? So we're going to explore that today. Welcome, Katiana. How are you today?
Hi, Julia. I'm doing good. Yourself?
All right. I'm surviving, I guess. like all of us, trying our best.
Yes.
As I'm sure you are too. Thank you so much for joining me today. So, you know, right off the bat, I think we all know that COVID-19, the public health crisis has turned also into a mental health crisis, right? And we know that school closures due to the pandemic have affected millions of students, not just here in Malaysia, all over, and it's put their learning, their development and mental health at risk. I mean, you work exclusively with children, with teenagers, with young adults. You know, just in your line of work alone, have you seen counselling sessions go up since the pandemic broke?
100%. Like, I think, you know, this, the current statistic is saying that we're seeing a 30 to 50% increase in individuals and young people specifically accessing mental health services. But even in my practice alone, I'm seeing 2 to 4-fold of the usual number of kids that I'm seeing, you know, just day to day. And largely due to the fact that they're having to cope with the changes brought on by this pandemic, namely school closures and sort of the consequences of that. So definitely we're seeing an increase. Which in a way, I guess the takeaway that I'm seeing is that a lot of it comes from parents expressing a lot more awareness over their child's struggles, because I think that previously it wasn't so obvious to them when everybody was working in at school and things like that. So the fact that they're coming forward is a positive in the sense that parents are embracing the idea of providing mental health support for their children, which is wonderful. But at the same time, just a very small picture of just how severe it's gotten for a lot of kids in this country.
Okay. And I mean, that's what we want to talk about. And I guess, you know, if you could help break it down for us, right? Like, what sort of mental health disorders are the kids experiencing? And also, can you break it down for us in terms of, you know, based on their ages, right? Because like I said, you speak to kids, teenagers, young adults. Can you help break that down?
Sure. So the little ones, or I call them the little ones. So we're looking at the age bracket, sort of like in the sort of kindergartners and early primary years. I think the most evident thing that I'm seeing are kids are not meeting their social milestones. So we're seeing kids presenting, you know, the little ones are presenting with speech delay and so, sort of like social aversion, because the only sort of interaction that they're getting oftentimes is with a device. And so we're seeing sort of what we call social reciprocal communication skills, the ability to have back and forth conversations are being impacted. The children who are verbal are then sort of becoming very uncomfortable to socialize or with regards to socializing with other children, because it's just such an odd experience for them. We have to remember that any child who is ages 2 and below were born during the pandemic.
That's right.
So this is all they know, right? So I have, you know, my goddaughter, for example, like, you know, would never know what it was like to play in a preschool because everything's just been sort of locked in. So it has definitely impacted their speech skills, their speech and communication skills, their socialization skills. So for the little ones, that's kind of the main thing. For the primary schoolers, we're looking at sort of up until maybe lower high school, up until that bracket. We're seeing some kids having issues with regards to things like anxiety and depression. We're seeing those two kind of make an appearance at this age because they're not getting that socialization, which is such an important component in that age bracket. Additionally, when we look at the school context, they're not getting the validation or the affirmation that they would normally get from their peers, from their teachers. And so there's a lot of anxiety over school performance because they feel like they don't know how they're doing. And so, you know, and then of course, just feeling very isolated, which isn't helping altogether. So we're seeing sort of that kind of come in at primary years. So I've got kids as young as 10, 9 around there who are presenting with symptoms of depression and anxiety already, because of the prolonged isolation. But I think it's not more evident than it is in my teenage bracket. So I've got quite the number of kids, especially the high performing children, actually, the ones who were normally doing very well in school, really struggling with the new format of doing everything virtually and not being able to collaborate and not getting the feedback that they're used to. And so, it's affecting motivation, it's affecting that, you know, wanting to attend classes. So definitely with my teenage group, they've been impacted quite significantly. So I'm seeing quite a number of cases coming forward with things like anxiety and depression, which unfortunately then also leads to things like self-harming behavior, eating disorders or food aversions. All of that kind of becomes like a domino effect when you see anxiety and depression make an appearance. So definitely, you know, regardless of what age bracket they're in, we're seeing impacts of it already because it has been such an extended period of time. So, you know, and then the fact that we aren't giving our kids so-called the light at the end of the tunnel, we're not giving them a deadline, it just becomes this prolonged sense of distress that they're feeling that they have to face. So it's, you know, different issues presenting in slightly different ways, but happening across the board.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious also, you know, because everybody's going through it, right? The whole world is going through it, right? And this is something that we tell ourselves, and I'm sure we tell our kids, you know, like, you just have to be resilient, you know,
yes.
This is just, you know, you just have to cope with it. I mean, yep. Is that actually helpful?
I mean, I think that it's not super helpful, to be honest. Reason being is because telling someone to be resilient doesn't tell them how, yeah. Right? And so when we tell our kids that they just have to overcome it, or to tell our kids that, you know, it's not that big a deal, because I've had some parents sort of downplay the severity of everything just to kind of keep their kids motivated. We have to factor in quite a few things. For starters, we're dealing with a demographic that hasn't been on Earth for very long. We're dealing with a six-year-old, it's only been 6 years that they've been on Earth, and already one third of their lifespan has been in lockdown. So I think we forget sometimes as adults the impact of how 1 or 2 years or how that might impact a child, because to us, 1 or 2 years is maybe that big a deal depending on how old we are. But for our kids, it might be a majority or a big chunk of their lifespan already. And so, you know, when we tell them that it's something that is, you know, when we minimize the impact of that, they don't know any better. Because it's been, you know, a big part of their life. And so when we say to them, you have to be resilient, you have to do this, you have to do that, you know, but we're not giving them the platform, or we're not giving them the tools on how to achieve that, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and I have to empathize with parents as well, because the reality of it is parents don't have the answers right now. You know, a lot of the clients I work with, you know, they can't tell their kids when schools are going to reopen. They can't tell their kids when they can see their friends again. So it is a challenge for parents as well to try to answer these questions on behalf of their children. So I find that the default, be resilient, you know, just look at what we're doing. We're all struggling. The whole world is struggling. But you know, I have this example that I tell my kids. I was like, you know, just because, you know, if you don't have a cookie in your hand, just because everyone says that, oh, everyone else has cookies, doesn't automatically refill your cookie.
Mm.
So telling people that the whole world is going through this from the mindset of a child, it might not be enough information for them to actually do something about it, you know? And then on top of that, the other thing we have to factor in is the fact that neurologically, their brains are still developing. So the region of the brain that's responsible for, you know, understanding the impact of long-term impact of things, emotional regulation, the ability to plan ahead, the things that make us functional adults, for children, you know, it's not fully matured yet.
Yeah.
So sometimes I think we run the risk of expecting too much of our children, because neurologically, from a hardware perspective, they're still growing. So all of this is stuff that they're learning and taking in, and they're going to be impacted by. But I do hear some adults kind of think that they should just brush it off. So
Yeah, that's really not helpful. And I guess, you know, that's also where school comes in, right? You know, all those interactions, all of that, this is where they learn how to also deal with these issues, right? I mean, I can imagine your teenagers, you know, there's hormones, there's so many things going on, right? And being with your peers and, you know, just having those conversations, in-person conversations is what can help them through it. And, you know, with schools closed, with them not being able to see each other, that's all just gone, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I know that a lot of people think that the virtual learning, you know, being able to Skype your friends or to video call your friends is a good sort of intermediary solution. And it 100% is, but we're not at the intermediary stage anymore. This has become a long-term solution. And so it's not at all the same type of interactions. I mean, kids are not being allowed to go outside and play. You know, they're not being allowed to play with each other, which is a huge important, you know, it's a huge developmental step for kids, especially when they're little, because playing teaches them more than what the screen can teach them. We're teaching them how to share. We're teaching them how to communicate. We're exposing them to the sensory world, which also has a whole impact that, you know, we're also not kind of calculating. But the thing, there's so much out of the face-to-face interactions that kids are not getting. And so the younger kids are really impacted because, you know, on the side, what we do know is that excessive screen time impacts not just speech development, it impacts attention skills, it impacts impulse control behavior. So there's all of these, you know, consequences to excessive screen time. And the irony is that before COVID, the guidelines that we had was that children under 2 should have 0 screen time.
Yeah.
Children up to 5 should have 30 minutes of screen time. But now they're getting hours and hours just to cope with school and to cope with interacting with people. So I think that there's so much from the face-to-face interactions that kids are not getting. And I fear, especially for the little ones, that it's not something that's going to be very easily rectified when we do go back to face-to-face. What I am expecting is that when schools reopen, we might have quite a number of kids presenting with social anxiety because they don't actually have, they've kind of been quite comfortable living in a bubble that they don't know how to engage when they need to. So, you know, I think that collectively the mental health field, we're all bracing ourselves for what, you know, COVID is going to, you know, what the impact of COVID is going to be from a mental health perspective, because we're already seeing those signs and, you know, whether or not we can rectify them in time.
Okay. All right. And we're going to come back and talk more about, you know, those long-term impacts that we need to brace ourselves for. I'm speaking today to Katiana Azman. She's a consultant child psychologist. This is part of our Buka Skola Kami campaign. You know, we are advocating, not for, you know, like a whole reopening of schools, but we're looking for, you know, sort of decentralized solutions. And maybe, you know, we're advocating for the reopening of schools to be prioritized on a national level, you know, and done in a safe way. And today we're discussing, you know, the impact of school closures on our children in terms of their mental and physical health, and also in terms of the development of their social, emotional and critical thinking skills. We'll come back and discuss that more after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and joining me on the line today is Katiana Azman. She's a consultant child psychologist, and this is part of the second part of our six-part series on why we need to reopen schools, why we need to start thinking about it, why we really need to start planning for it. It's part of a larger campaign called Buka Skola Kami. Today, we're focusing on why on how school closures impact children, especially in terms of their mental and physical health. But we're focusing more on the mental health. And, you know, Katiana, before the break, you told us how you've seen an increase in you know, people coming to see you, in kids, younger adults, teenagers coming to see you. And we were very worried about long-term effects, right? I mean, never mind now what they're going through. We don't quite know how it's going to play out, you know, years down the line, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's what research is showing as well.
Exactly. So, I mean, the only way that we can calculate, I mean, in psychology, we love something called longitudinal studies. So we love things that, yes, you know, span generations, where we can kind of come up with a model in determining how things are going to play out. But this is a very unique circumstance. And so we might not really fully appreciate what the consequences are going to be. But from what we're seeing, and I think the conversation that's being had in the mental health arena at the moment, especially in Malaysia, given the fact that you know, we are pretty short-staffed when it comes to mental health professionals in this country. Yeah. I was recently told, quite frighteningly really, that for a country with a population size as ours, we should be having about 3,000 psychologists or mental health professionals. We have about 400. Oh, so it is, you know, and so I think the fear that we're all having is that when the inevitable final wave of COVID, which I think globally everyone is calling the mental health wave, inevitably hits Malaysia, we might not have the manpower that we do with the medical side of things to be able to support the volume of people that are going to need help. So definitely, just without factoring in age, that is something that we're all concerned about. So that's why there's so much conversation about, you know, individuals losing their jobs and losing their homes, and about getting people back to the workforce and things like that, because there's an impact seen from the adult perspective, but definitely from the child perspective. The long-term effects that we're concerned about in, from a mental health standpoint, definitely the increase of things like depression and anxiety, mood disorders and anxiety disorders, which we're already seeing today. We're worried about the impact of, again, sort of like the social development of kids, because if they're spending a big chunk of their time not socializing, what that's going to do. I think also just linking to anxiety, we're also seeing a larger generation of kids coming up with different phobias, because a lot of the narrative surrounding COVID-19 and the SOPs have been fear driven.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of parents are telling their kids, like, don't do this, don't do that, or you're going to get COVID, right? but, you know, it's a common tactic that everyone employs, right? Yeah. But I think that we're creating, I've seen already some of my kids who are extremely germophobic. I've seen kids who are extremely having issues with social phobia just from the 2 years that we've already, or the 1.5 years that we've spent locked in already. So, and I think just also academically, there's that to factor in as well, right? Because most of my kids, I call them my kids, but most of my clients will tell you, if you ask them if they've learned anything in the last 1.5 years, most of them would probably say no. A lot of families are pulling their children out of school because they're not functioning with the virtual learning. Most kids who are attending Sekolah Kebangsaan have to deal with 40 to 45 kids on one screen with one teacher. So if you have, you know, different learning needs, you're not getting that addressed. So there are going to be long-term impacts from this lockdown, even though it's only been a year and a half long. I've spoken to my colleagues in the pediatrics field, so the medical field, and they've been telling me things like, you know, they're seeing a larger group of children coming in with issues with being overweight and obesity from, you know, kind of being at the computer snacking like we all do.
Yeah.
So we have more kids coming in with weight-related issues. One of my colleagues was saying a lot of kids are coming in with vision issues from just the incessant number of hours staring at a screen. So there's a lot of physical and sort of medical consequences we're seeing, as well as the mental health ones. But I think just more frighteningly are the statistics that are coming out with the number of kids who are self-harming and taking their lives as a byproduct. And it's actually quite frightening. And remember again that, you know, the topic of suicide is still very, very, it's a difficult topic to discuss here in Malaysia. So a lot of the statistics are, in our opinion, not true. They're more underreported. And the statistics we have for the moment already is something like 3 kids a day. And that's between the ages of 15 to 18. So young. And so it's quite frightening what's happening already. And so I think, you know, part of the reason why I wanted to be a part of this conversation was just because I just don't want to have to wait and see what happens if we keep doing this, right? So for the long term, those are all the things that we know will happen. But, you know, there could be more that we can't figure out yet.
Oh my gosh. And I was reading that, you know, school routines are very important, especially as coping mechanisms for all young people, but more so for those who have mental health issues. Is that correct?
Yes. Absolutely. So kids with mental health issues, even kids with learning difficulties, and not just mental health issues, thrive on structure. Mm. So they need to be able to have a routine. They need to be able to have confidence in themselves that comes from executing those routines. So all of this has been a proper upheaval for a lot of these kids. So, you know, kids, for example, who have issues with anxiety, they need to have that sort of control that comes with being able to plan things out and follow a particular structure. And they haven't been able to do that. And so kids with, you know, kids with learning issues, even more so, they're not able to kind of hinge on the scaffolding that comes with all of these learning programs and these structures and routines that they get from that. So having a lot of things kind of thrown up in the air, they're expected to kind of manage themselves more independently because teachers are not able to be as, you know, present. Parents are working most of the time. So often what I'm seeing is that my kids who were presenting with symptoms of anxiety and depression are just not attending virtual lessons altogether. They're just keeping their cameras off and they're kind of isolating because they're overwhelmed. They can't cope with having to be, you know, the person in charge of not just their education, but their mental health and, you know, their day-to-day life. It's almost too much. So a lot of these kids are just disappearing and falling through the cracks. But because of the sheer number of students that teachers have to supervise on one screen, oftentimes teachers don't notice and parents don't notice because kids are doing these sessions in their bedrooms. So it's not something that we're seeing much positives in, I would have to say.
Yeah, and even those kids who, you know, maybe home is not the safest place for them, or home is not the happiest place for them. I mean, school was the outlet, isn't it? School was the escape from a less than satisfactory home life. And that too has been taken away and probably will doubly impact their, or probably already impacted mental health.
Precisely. So we've already seen and heard about the increased number in domestic abuse cases since the lockdowns have begun. And that translates as well to the kids who are living in these households, right? So platforms such as, you know, Befrienders and PS the Children, they've seen an increase in Talian Kasih. They've seen a lot of cases, a lot of calls coming in since the pandemic began. And so, you know, yes, school was a safe haven for a lot of kids. It's also an avenue with which kids saw themselves bettering their lives, and not being able to do that was also an issue. I've had some of my colleagues, like I believe, you know, Joanna from the first episode was telling me as well that, you know, school was where a lot of kids got their meals for the day. And that's now also off the table. So I think it's not just about learning. And I think that's where we have to put our foot down, or to reinstate that fact that going back to school, opening schools, is not just about the academics. It's about, you know, like you said, the physical health, the emotional development, the psychological one, the safety. So there's a lot more elements that are being involved with kids going back to school. So the kids are really suffering being stuck indoors because of it.
Mm-hmm. Part of this campaign is, again, as we keep saying, we're advocating for schools to be reopened in a safe manner. I remember in our first episode, our guest was saying how we've had 2 years to plan for this, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like it's new. We should have come up with better solutions now. Mm. I mean, what would you add to that discussion? You know, like, I mean, how can we go back safely to school? I know that many of our listeners are not happy with this. You know, we got some comments last week. They're like, what's wrong with you? Look at the numbers. How can you send them back? But I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think I find myself in a bit of a unique position because I kind of work in the in-between. Like, I work in a hospital setting, so I have doctors in the medical side who, of course, are very much like a lot of these parents, looking at the statistics and the fact that children are getting COVID and they're not able to be vaccinated depending on how old they are. So I'm kind of privy to that. But at the same time, I'm part of the conversation where I'm seeing the impact of that decision, right? So I'm kind of in the in-between. And so what I'd have to say is that, you know, I personally am very cognizant of the fact that the risk is present. I'm very cognizant of the fact that, you know, kids are getting sick and the numbers are high, though I must say that, you know, the vaccines, from the sound of it, have been doing an excellent job in bringing the severity down. I believe it's something like 2% out of the total every day that's, you know, categories 3 and above. But, you know, I think that this whole conversation, or having this conversation, is not about ignoring those numbers and saying that, you know, it's completely safe for kids to go back to school. No, of course not. You know, and back to what you were saying, it's about advocating of a way to make sure that it's being done safely. Our concern is that if we continue to ignore that this conversation needs to be had, by the time we need to have it, how many years would have gone by?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that it is not a conversation isn't going to to hurt anyone in terms of planning and thinking it through. So what, you know, what I've been advocating for is, of course, to make sure that we make it as safe as possible, looking at making sure that everybody who can be vaccinated is vaccinated before they are able to go back to school. We're not going to, in my opinion, we shouldn't be forcing anybody's hand, but rather making it something that is possibly voluntary, where people who feel that it is, who might have different feelings about sending their kids to school will get the option to. And those who feel that children should stay home will get the option to continue on with virtual learning. So it's not about really forcing it down anybody's throat. And the same goes down with the vaccination system or the vaccination program, where you should be able to make your own decisions and have, you know, certain options presented to you. So, you know, some of the things that I was thinking is, you know, making sure that we are able to take certain precautions. So maybe looking at things like having very much what companies are doing, like a team A, team B system, where kids can rotate between virtual learning and physical learning or face-to-face learning, having kids sort of remain in bubbles where they're interacting with maybe just one class and not multiple classes and multiple people. So there's a lot of options that are still on the table, which of course we need to make with the information we have about the about the virus and the variants that are being, you know, that are popping up every once in a while. But, you know, I think it's about planning. And I kind of agree with what the guests from the first episode were saying. I think that up until now, the conversation has always been about not talking about it because it was just, there was no point, you know, so having these blanket policies until such a time where the numbers are zero or close to zero, where we can revisit the issue. But we don't know when that's going to be, right?
And or if ever.
If ever, exactly, right? I mean, if they declare COVID endemic, which is what they plan on doing soon, hopefully, that's declaring that this virus will live with us, right? And we're not looking at a zero rate anyway. So what are we going to be looking at, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's more along the lines of, to me, the cost of it is one that I'm not willing to pay. I'm looking at my clients and what they're going through, and I feel like this is just not something that I can foresee them continuing to do for the foreseeable future. So a conversation needs to be had, because at least hopefully when the numbers do come down, we'll have an idea or a framework of what we're set out to do. So you know, I've been looking into a lot of the guidelines that's being issued by organizations like the CDC, because I believe like in the US, the schools have reopened and the guidelines that they're adopting. And of course, they do it with a certain number of risk involved, but there are steps that we can take in order to minimize that risk. So I think factoring that in along with making it voluntary so that parents don't feel compelled to go against their beliefs and their, you know, their parental gut instinct to send their kids into, you know, a dangerous situation, but also not making that a policy that everybody has to accept. You know, so I think that's a good place for us to start until we get a little bit more of an understanding of this virus and how it works and how to keep our kids safe. But saying no entirely is not the solution either.
Yeah. And, you know, as you've already lined out, the costs are far outweighing the benefits of, you know, just keeping them at home. We're going to see some severe long-term impacts. We're talking about kids, at least the kids that you see, your kids have access to help. You know, what about those so many of those other kids who don't? We don't even know what's going to happen with them.
Yeah, the sad reality with mental health services is that, you know, one, we are outnumbered, and two, we are centralized to the big cities. So we're also considering kids like in the urban areas or in the kampung areas. We're not getting the same access, right? And so I've reached a point where I've had to turn kids away because I have no more slots to give. And that breaks my heart because I don't want to do that. So, you know, it's just to give you some context, like I did this little, I just out of curiosity decided to look up, you know, what is the average in terms of hours that psychologists are supposed to be doing. And in the US, it's something like 19 hours a week of patient contact. I'm doing about 50.
Oh my word.
You know, and that's just because there's not enough, you know, mental health professionals to support the sheer number of kids coming in. So, you know, definitely something that we have to consider. So, you know, I can understand and I hear the concerns that parents have. I've had a lot of parents tell me, you don't have kids of your own, biological kids of your own, so you don't share our feelings. But I'd like to think that, you know, I support quite a few hundred of them.
I would think so too. Gosh, what an awful thing to say.
You know, but I can see, I understand that the concern is there. The risk is there. The fear is valid. So it's, you know, again, not about telling you you have to send your kids to school right now. It's about giving parents the options, right? Giving them informed, you know, giving them the ability to have informed opinion about what they're supposed to do. And then, you know, we even tossed around ideas like having a pilot study where we could kind of have certain schools open up to get the data that we're lacking over whether or not it really is a risk, because we have some parts of the conversation, some people saying, well, children, schools are not responsible for the community spread, whereas some people say that it's the contrary. So we don't have, reality is we don't have the data to say yes or no. So whether or not maybe it's about getting that data by opening up some pilot programs in schools, having, you know, kids go in and then figure it out. But then I've had some people say, well, aren't we then turning our kids into guinea pigs then? You know, so I think that it's such a difficult conversation to have, but one that we should have so that when everything calms down, we'll have a plan and we're not putting our kids on the bench for another months or years till we figure it out.
Yeah, and that is exactly what we're calling for, right? An end to blanket policies, because blanket policies don't work.
Yes.
So we are looking for different solutions. We're looking for, you know, everybody to come together, all of society to come together to find ways to get back safely, to get to think of the children.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing is, I the most enlightening thing was I had a conversation with one of my colleagues who's a public health specialist the other day. And, you know, and one of the things that was being discussed was the fact that, you know, when COVID first arrived, you know, in Malaysia, it was about crisis mode. You know, we fashioned together SOPs and policies that worked to protect our people in a crisis situation. But we are now 2 years into it, and we are, you know, the numbers are still high, but, you know, we now need to move away from that crisis mindset, you know, and start thinking about long-term planning, right? And like I said, like COVID wasn't something that just came and went, it's endemic, right? So I think that that's where a lot of doctors are now, and a lot of policymakers are looking at, you know what, we can't keep our borders closed. We can't be doing things in this blanket way anymore, because this virus is here to stay, you know? So I can kind of see how now there's been a call, even in the medical sector, a call for changing how we look at the virus and how we, you know, we deal with it. Even just how we're reporting about the virus is now changing as well, if you look at how the KKM is communicating it as well. So, you know, I think that that's what's what resonates with me as well. This was a method that served a purpose when, you know, when we had no clue what was going on, when we had no vaccines. It was a good interim solution, but it's no longer working. And so we need to be able to come up with a plan so that, you know, and the thing that you know, always sticks out with me is that the people who are making the decisions are the adults, but the people who are going to be impacted are the children.
Yeah.
They don't get a seat at the table. They don't get to make these decisions. So I feel like it's our duty to be able to speak for them, right? And to be able to advocate for what is going to affect them. I mean, we might think it's fine, right? But they're not, and they don't get to make that comment or to make that decision. So I think more the reason why those of us who have the ability to shed light on what's affecting kids, we should.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, you know, Katiana, for speaking with me today. Any last message that you'd like to leave us with before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I the one thing I'd like to share is I know that it is an extremely difficult time for parents and children alike, and that if anyone who's listening finds themselves, you know, really distressed or troubled or just needing someone to talk to, you know, these services, though I've been saying how short-staffed we are, but these services are available here. So reach out for help. And that, you know, at the end of the day, it's about the goal is about making sure that everybody, you know, moves on from this pandemic in one piece. And so, you know, if getting help is the way that you do that, know that there's no shame in that and that there's always help available.
Yep. Okay. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking to Katiana Azman. She's a consultant child psychologist. She was talking to us about school closures and the impact on children's development. You know, we're discussing this as part of a larger campaign called Buka Skola Kami, where we're looking for an end to blanket policies. We're looking for some decentralized solutions, you know, to help the kids, because this pandemic is not ending and it's really impacting them and it's going to impact them for the long term. So looking for solutions, you know, rather than blanket sort of policies. If you'd like to find out more about this campaign, just search for the hashtag Buka Skola Kami online. If you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/learn, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.